I say this every time, but I'm so excited today to talk to the person I'm talking to for this podcast. Welcome to the Faith and Justice Network podcast, where we get to talk about what's going on in, you know, the Faith and Justice Network, but also we get to talk to cool people about their spiritual practices, which is something you don't always get to talk to people about and get to share about. And I think spiritual practices are much bigger and much weirder than, say, I grew up thinking they were. And so today I get to talk to Robert Monson, who is on Twitter as Robert the Contemplative. So that makes me think you maybe have some spiritual practices. Hi, Robert.
Hello, hello, hello. I do. I try to, at least. And thanks for having me. I'm excited.
It's so great. And this is the first time we have, like, spoken and seen each other's faces over the computer. So I am somebody who's followed you, you know, on Twitter. And there's probably a little bit of that weird, you know, parasocial stuff happening, is because you are, like, a genuinely real person on the internet, which doesn't happen very often. And when you put yourself out there in your fullness, you know, I'm just drawn to that. I know a lot of people are. And so I feel like I already know you, but I know I can't presume to know you, which is why I'm so excited to just talk about a few things today.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I think there's this whole notion of, and some of it is backed up by studies, of get off the internet and go enjoy your real life. And social media is toxic, and it can be. But I think there is a way to do social media where you present yourself as yourself and galvanize around authenticity, where there doesn't have to be masking involved. And yeah, you can build social media to be what it is that you want to see. So I enjoy social media in the way that I interact with it.
Yeah, you have a lot of intentionality behind, you know, your authenticity. And I think that is just so clear. And so, you know, for people who don't know you, who maybe, you know, aren't graced with your presence on Twitter yet, you know, I just want to say you are part of a podcast, the Three Black Men podcast. You have a Substack and you hang out on Twitter and are just amazing on Twitter. Is there anything else you want to tell us, you know, about, you know, kind of the stuff you do in public?
Yeah, so the Three Black Men podcast formed out of interactions on Twitter. Me and the other two Black men, we interacted first over just online discussions, and that became a group chat where I kind of forced interactions together. I just created a DM group and I was like, y'all gonna be my friends. Literally, that's how it went. We're gonna interact and we're gonna have community. And that formed into a 2.5 year long friendship. And out of that came a podcast of the conversations that we were having about life and theology and the world around us and different things. And then my Substack, which is Musings from a Broken Heart, and Theology from this Broken Hearted Place, kind of came out of just the way that I see the world. And it just became a place to house a lot of the poetry and the theology that I do. And aside from all that, I have another podcast, Black Coffee and Theology, that where I just sit down with people, whether it's regular everyday people or established theologians, teachers, and we just sit down over a cup of tea or coffee, and we just talk about our lived experiences, theological conversation, and have conversations. So that's what I'd be doing as far as public facing things.
I love it. And are you in seminary right now?
Yes.
You're doing something that involves a lot of, like, writing and theses presenting, right?
Yes. So I'm in seminary. And this is my last semester. And I am trucking towards this finish line. So in the midst of writing my thesis, co-authoring some things, presenting at some scholarly conferences. So I feel like I am all over the place.
Yeah. And the, oh my gosh, you're so close to the finish line. I can't believe you're taking the time to talk to me. That means a lot because you're in the thick of it. So one thing I like to ask people is just like, how are you coming into this conversation like right now? How are you doing right now? How are you feeling?
That is a great question. I love that question. I am coming into this conversation off of a run. I went running earlier, and running for me is meditative, and it's the way that I don't get me emotional, child. So the world is so busy, and the world is constantly trying to tell me to go this way and that way. And running for me is my way to slow everything down, which sounds oxymoronic. But I'm not running Marion Jones style. I'm not like out here like before you think, man, he's out here moving and grooving. No, I love running super slow. Like nothing delights me more than, especially on Sundays when we're recording this, going for a long slow run in a park, in a beautiful park, and seeing nature and being in the sunlight. And so for me, I enter this space really peaceful, actually.
I love that you brought up being a slow runner, because I am a slow runner. And so I didn't think I could call myself a runner. I'm like, I'm just a person who plods around, you know, the neighborhood. But I spend a lot of my life and a lot of my time like sort of trapped in a conversation with my thoughts, some of which are just very anxious and circular thoughts. And finding a way to be in my body has become a huge spiritual practice for me. And so if it's walking or running, I have to do one of those things during a day or my mental health will suffer. And so I 100% agree. And my husband even told me, he's like, I can tell the days you go walking and the days you go running because you come back different. Like, and running truly helps you just get out of your head a little bit more than walking, you know, I gotta say. But I pay attention to my neighborhood more when I'm walking, and then I pay attention to myself more when I'm running. So it's just fascinating. I gotta think about that. But I love that you brought that up. I also want to say, you know, I'm coming into this, it's also a sunny day. So therefore I'm like, I think we're going to make it, Robert. I think we're going to make it because it's a beautiful sunny day.
Truly.
Me and my 11-year-old were talking about, we survived January, you know, in Portland, which is a big deal. Like, we survived it. Like, that's good.
That's right.
That's good, right?
Yeah.
So that, but I also love how I was trying to set up this time to record with you. It totally never once crossed my mind that this is Super Bowl Sunday. And I don't know if you were aware of that.
I do not care.
I gotta just bring it up. I just gotta bring it up. Yeah, okay. Neither of us care.
Listen, the way that I don't care is I do not even know who's playing. So
I don't either, but I was like, what if Robert does care? And I was just so cavalier. I was like, you know, just do this.
I know
instead.
That this is like the religion of the land, but I do not care.
Okay. So watching football is not one of your spiritual practices. Is that what you're telling me?
I am not American, apparently.
Oh, I knew I liked you. Okay,
yes,
so
exactly.
Now that I've just alienated whoever does like football.
We love you. It's just not for
it's just
me.
Not for us. It's just not for us. And we're not hating on you, and we think you have good taste in snacks, but we don't understand the game.
Yeah,
okay.
Now I'll come over for the snacks, though.
Well, I'm sort of like let's just have snacks and not turn a game on at all. But that's just me. And I live my life. This is one of my spiritual practices. Okay, here we go. I don't diet, right? I don't think about any of that. I am like, what can nourish my body today? You know how many treats I have a day, Robert? I have so many little treats I eat a day. Oh, anyways. I mean, 7-layer dip, I just make it. If I want it, I just make it. And I eat it. I don't wait for the Super Bowl.
I got it. Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. Sure. But we're here to talk about your spiritual practices. So when I asked you if you wanted to, you know, tell me about some of these things, I'm curious, like, for you, what came up for you? What were some of the first things that you're like, oh, yeah, here's some spiritual practices I engage?
I'm glad running came up and embodied practices came up, because one of the first things that I think of is combating anxiety. So that I have always been an anxious, both child and now man. And that is one way that I interface with the world, is as an anxious person, and one who struggles with depression. And so being able to feel my body and think about what is a practice, a spiritual practice that grounds me. So running is definitely one of them. And then a spiritual practice people don't often talk about is poetry. Mm-hmm. And it's one that churches don't often talk about, or, you know, when you talk about what are the spiritual disciplines, spiritual practices, poetry has given me so much life and breath and joy. So however people take this, whatever you call the time where you sit down with God, the divine, I still do it in the mornings because that just works for me. I read poetry and write poetry every single day. At least I try to. And whether that's a few minutes every morning. And it gives me so much joy. Some of my favorite authors and poets are Morgan Harper Nichols. Mm-hmm. And I say Morgan Harper Nichols because there's something beautiful about the way she writes. And in her books, she has a lot of visuals for me that are breathtaking. And that combines the seeing aspect and the reading aspect that I can only take in a little bit at a time. And for me, that is as sacred as scripture for me. And maybe for those who struggle with even reading the Bible, I would point to poetry as a way to ground yourself. And so there's something about the way that she writes that's really healing to me. I'm thinking about something I just read this morning about the lost and the broken heart. And there were some tears shed this morning, and the insecure heart. And I can only read a page or two of Morgan Harper Nichols, and then I got to close the book up.
Wow.
And sit with it. Go ahead.
I know her mostly as a visual artist. And so now I'm like, I need to go get her books and read her poetry. You know, yeah. Like I've not really done that. And I wonder if other people listening, you know, like the coolest people in my life all love poetry. And I got to be honest, Robert, I struggle with poetry. And I wonder if you can even maybe just talk through that a little bit, because I can't be the only person in your life who's like, I don't get poetry, especially as a spiritual discipline, because I was raised, right, to read the Bible every morning, hear from God, and hopefully that matched up with whatever the white men, you know, in my denomination said that scripture meant, right? Mm-hmm. And so now I really need help having an imagination. And about being radically honest. But I tried, even today I tried. I was reading this Catholic magazine. It's sort of like supposedly leftist. It's called Commonweal. And they have some poetry scattered throughout the magazine. I tried to read the poetry and I was like, I am done listening to people write poems about the beach. Like, I guess that's great. I like the beach just fine. But if I have to like read one more poem about the beach, like it's just not helping me. And I know I can't be the only one. So I'm sorry if I'm just putting you on the spot here.
But I love it.
I want to learn more about, I know it's so important to people.
Yeah. So two things. I love this question. Two things. I think one about scripture and about the ways in which we were taught growing up. And I say this as one who grew up as an atheist. And so looking at the ways in which friends and loved ones grew up in the way that scripture was maybe weaponized against them, which saddens me often, and crushes me often as I watch them struggle to kind of collect the ashes of their childhood. I think.
Did you just write a poem? Sounded like one. Sorry to interrupt.
It's sad because then they're struggling with the ways that the divine can speak to them. And for me, what is lost is an incalculable loss at all of the ways that the divine can speak. And what is constricted in that tight view of God at this is the only way is you miss all of the ways that the divine is speaking, has spoken, and will speak again. And the way that God speaks to us in the sunrise, the way that God speaks to us in communal love, and that is lost in ashes, right? And and that when scripture is weaponized like that, people lose all the way around, right? And trying to control the divine and trying to control against the slippery slope, it's a mess, child. It's a whole mess. But I think to poetry, good poetry, I'll say that, not just any poetry, because bad poetry, I'm not a fan of. it does the opposite. So I'm not talking about like your Dr. Seuss, but I think of like Lucille Clifton. I think of Alice Walker's Hard Times Require Furious Dancing. I think of Amanda Gorman and these different ones who are writing these prophetic poems that are talking about the human experience. They are writing these poems that to me are communicating the divine into now, right? That tagline from Alice Walker, Hard Times Require Furious Dancing, I read at the beginning of the pandemic, and little did I know that would be the anthem for this whole pandemic. These are indeed hard times. And they do require furious dancing. For me, that became an anchor for me during the most depressing times stuck in the house. I'm like, Alice Walker had no idea. So I would even, I'm going to read a section of this poem from Morgan Harper Nichols, All Along You Were Blooming. So she wrote, if there is ever a day when you are overwhelmed by a crowd of expectations and you are not ready to throw yourself on the line in the way that those above you seem to want you to, may you know this to be true. You do not have to keep or meet every gatekeeper's expectations of you in order to show up in a way that is true. And when I was reading that, that moved me in thinking, like my whole life I've been a people pleaser. And her saying, hey, you don't have to show up for every gatekeeper's expectations of you. Like, essentially, she's saying, like, you get to show up in a way that is true to yourself. And for me, there's a lot of resonance with that. Like, and for me, I'll just sit with every line of that poem. Like, for me, when scripture is hard to bear, sometimes the poets can say it in a way that scripture can't for me, you know? Poets can say things in a way that get straight to your heart in a way that maybe scripture has been weaponized against you. Because her saying, you do not have to meet every gatekeeper's expectations of you. Sure, that's Psalm 139 if you were to, you know, if you wanted to make it churchy. You're fearfully and wonderfully made, but maybe you've heard that in a way that you can't, like, hear now. But maybe you need to hear somebody say, you do not have to meet every gatekeeper's expectations of you. Yeah, and so poets sometimes have spiritual lessons to teach us, you know.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Is it important for you to, like, engage with that poem, which I agree is so beautiful? Do you need to, like, have a personal connection to the poet for it to move you in a certain way? Like, do you need to know their sort of, like, political, social location? Because I know you talk a lot about womanist theology, right? And I just heard Brandy Miller speak at my church online today, and she was talking about how womanist theology, you know, is just, what is she? It's like consciously contextual, right? And so when you grow up in white evangelicalism, like I did, right, it's the opposite. The white men are like, no. We just know the logical way to read it. We're not reading it as a reformed white man, you know, we just know the best way to read it. And so I'm thinking about this, like, consciously contextual, and how that's really helped me engage with scriptures in recent years, right? Trying to reclaim some of these ashes of my own life. And I'm just wondering, is that the same with poetry, or is it can kind of transcend? Because I get a little stuck sometimes. Like, I need to know exactly where someone's coming from before I can assign weight to their words. But I'm probably doing poetry wrong. So I don't know.
I think it can be both. I think it can be both. I think with poetry, especially from those divesting, it is the act of letting go of control. And sometimes what can happen, is, even in decolonizing work, what can unintentionally happen is we can try to recolonize our spiritual practices. And we can find ourselves trying to, you know, and so poetry, I hear you. Now, it does matter a little bit about where somebody's coming from. Because, you know, how did you vote in the last election?
It matters. It does.
It does. It does matter a little bit. Like now, yeah. Now, come yeah. on. Let's not be wild. Where were you on January 6th?
Oh, yeah.
Let's not be silly. Yeah. Tricks are for kids. Like, I'm not that contemplative. Like, now that aside, now once I determined your whereabouts on January of the 6th, aside from that, what I like is losing myself in all of the expansive ways of people and practices that I don't know, in all of the streams, right? And that is the beauty that I see. And that's why I study so many streams of theological depths and practices. I study indigenous poets. Because even when it's foreign to me, I want to sit with the beauty. I want to sit with, I don't know where it comes from, but I just want to hear the beautiful, what is this evoking in me? oh, this is kind of foreign, but does foreign equal, is that alienness? Is that bad to me? And, oh, wait, this is kind of unusual. And I feel like God's like, okay. I'm like, I feel, you know, it's like, this is a roller coaster. I'm like, God, is alien bad to you? I'm like, well, I guess no.
Hmm.
Okay, this is actually kind of cool. I like it. Mm. You know, and so in that way, poetry can be a doorway to the spiritual practice. It can be a spiritual doorway to the divine in ways that you never could have encountered on your own. And so that's what the gift of womanism has been to me, because I'm not a Black woman, right? And it opened doors for me that there was so much beauty there, so much life there, that I found like, oh, there's some good fruit over here.
Mm.
You know, but the initial doorway was foreign to me, right?
Yeah. No, I think that helps me so much, is because I obviously have this in my own background and life. Just what's the best way to be a human? What's the absolute 100% best way to be a Christian? What's the best poetry to read, and how's the best way to interpret it? Like, I still get so bogged down in all of that stuff, and that's not great. It's not a fun way to live, honestly.
And I think the best way is what is the most foreign to you. And so that kind of is the ethic that I live by, is what is alien to me, what is foreign to me, and which is a spiritual practice for how I live my life too, which is another spiritual practice, is I embrace those things that are alien to me and use that as a spiritual ethic and a practice in going after those things, and not letting them be intimidating to me. Like, they are scary, but letting that be a doorway to the divine, right? And so I pick up things by, when I'm looking at poetry, what's the most not like me? Okay, mm. I'm going to pick up tons of Black women poets, right? And see what they're writing about. I'm like, oh, okay. This is, how are they describing things? Well, they are not describing it how I would describe it, because I'm a Black man, right? Like, mm-hmm. But I'm like, okay, it's good. And I find so much life in the margins, so to speak. I find so much life in what I would have once called alien, but now I don't know where I begin in this quote unquote alien thing that was alien to me, but now I see so much beauty in it. I would never call it alien or foreign now. Now I see that is normal now.
Hmm.
And now my thinking is alien.
I love that. So to me, what you're saying is, you know, one of your spiritual practices, you know, is one of cultivating curiosity, right? And
yes, that's a good way to say it.
Because you do, you know, this is one of the things I love about you. And if people, you know, haven't, you know, been able to hear your work or you know, read your tweets or anything, it's like you obviously are a very curious person, mm-hmm. and you have a lot of playfulness in you. Mm-hmm. But to me, the root of those things is grief and mm-hmm. suffering has somehow, you have taken that and become a more curious person. And we know that's not what happens to everybody, mm-hmm. right? Who experiences deep trauma and pain and suffering. So I, you know, you feel free to share as much as you want, but I just wondered if that resonates. Like, that's where I see so much of your curiosity, playfulness, but also like the deep richness of your thoughts. Honestly, your thoughts on the world come from a very deep place, you know, and to me, they are all springing from this place of I've experienced grief. And to me, that's still something our culture, social media, you cannot talk about grief in a long-term sustained way. You can have a mental breakdown and you best be over it in 2 weeks. Truly. You know what I mean? Like, or people do not know what to do with you.
Mm.
So that's where I see some of your spiritual practices coming into play here, is you allowing yourself to be fully human, to be curious. I don't know. Does any of this resonate?
It does. Like, no, it it really does. I think my whole life, in a way, my whole life has been intertwined with grief. And so I didn't connect that piece to curiosity until you just said that. So that is a new thing that I'm thinking about on the spot. So thank you for that. When I think about it, my birth was shaped in grief and trauma. So I have never known a life outside of grief. My home life was chaotic and dysfunctional. And so I don't have a control group for, like, so this was life pre-grief and after grief. My life has been one chaotic event to another. And so it's been unfolding in more traumatic ways, with small seasons of respite. Like, catch your breath, because we're about to into the thick of it. And so in the midst of that, even growing up atheist, I was always a curious child. And so I think in the seedbed of grief, I was curious about a world outside of what I was experiencing, inside of what I was experiencing. I wanted to know what made the world tick. And so as I've gotten older, and as I saw what moved people, I was curious about, even as a young child, I was curious as to why people hurt, or why people did the things that hurt other people. I was curious about systemic issues. I mean, even being at 7 years old, I mean, I grew up as an atheist, so these weren't Christian qualities, you know, because Christian supremacy means that, like, only Christians are curious about these things. I was an atheist. There's spiritual formation happening, y'all. But I was curious about systemic issues as a child, and I was curious about other cultures. And as I've gotten older, that curiosity grew and grew and grew and grew. And I have endeavored to, as my grief grew and grew and grew, and more traumatic incidents have happened in my life that have threatened my very existence, whether it's illness that has racked my body, whether it's deaths that have completely shattered my life and caused me literally to lose my mind. It has made me wonder, how do people continue to function in this broken world? I am curious because I know what it's like to lose everything. And be expected to keep going, you know, that curiosity is born out of how does one be expected to keep going when your world is shattered? And that felt like this system is sick. So for me, I think that curiosity is very much linked to, this world is not okay. And I feel like at times I've been the only one that, like, this is sick. Like, I feel like I'm the one detaching from the matrix enough to say, hey, hey, let me off this ride. You know, and so my curiosity is like, I know everyone else isn't okay. but everyone is just cool with this. Somehow we've all been okay, you know, and I see that somehow we've just all accepted this. And so my curiosity has become one of somehow everyone is expected to survive, you know? And so so all that to say, I think cultivating deep curiosity is a spiritual ethic now. It's moved even beyond a spiritual practice. It's, I want people to survive, for me. And so I care about rooting out misogyny, rooting out racism. I care about Christian supremacy and I care about attending to those who grieve, because I know how my life has been impacted by all those things. So,
wow. Okay. Well, first of all, Christian supremacy is the one nobody wants to talk about. So I love that you brought it up. And I think, you know, even just taking a step back, I don't want to like presume, but for curiosity to be a spiritual practice, you know, and to say something is terribly wrong with the world, right? I think the thing that propels me forward is like, I think God really loves everybody. And I don't think God is okay with it being the way it is. That's been an important reframe for me, one that I want to keep with me, is this idea. I grew up hearing that God so loved the world. But when you take that seriously, like if you take seriously the fact that you're beloved just as you are, even if you can't produce much in a capitalistic society, you know, if you take it seriously that everybody's beloved, it is just, it doesn't make your life easier at all, but it does keep you moving forward in curiosity. So I don't want to presume there, but I'm wondering if there are any practices you have that help with sort of that baseline beloved, made in the image of God kind of baseline you have to keep going.
Yeah. Whew. Beloved. That reminds me of a book by Henry Nouwen, actually, on that very topic. I think of first the principle that I have in the care practice that I have of, I use all the PTO that I can. And I say that funnily, tongue in cheek, and in reality. Listen, I use PTO for any reason, all reasons. If the sky looks crooked outside, I'm going to use it today. This is very real. listen. Seriously. But there's something sick about our society when there are stats literally that people don't use all their PTO in a year, in American society. There's something wrong with us. And so I literally have a spiritual care practice of, I use all my PTO.
I love it.
I'm the beloved of God. I save it all for the end of the year. I'm not saving it all for the God. So I use all my PTO. And then I enter this conversation as one who, listen, I have a number of chronic health issues. And so what beloved means to me is something different for those who are able-bodied, and able-minded. And so for me, that word means something in actuality for me. And so I have to care for myself. And so PTO has something to do with that. I have to really monitor my energy levels. I have to, for me, I have a spiritual care practice of updating my friends on, hey, when I have flare-ups, I actually update my friends and saying, hey, I need care. I'm not doing well. And I know there's like, that might not seem like that's a spiritual practice, but for someone who is not able-bodied, and I would say actually, let me blow that apart. Even able-bodied people, your body is part of your spiritual care. You just don't have to think about it.
Exactly.
You just.
And society's not reminding you.
Yes.
Day in and day out, that you're not valuable. So you
yeah, know, yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. So you get you can kind of swerve around it.
Yeah.
People who are not able-bodied, you do not get that luxury. Your body hates you and society hates you. So and the church hates you. So so it's like so it's a triple entendre. So for me, I told you we go laugh.
I know. I'm like trying not to lose it laughing, but it's like, I wish it wasn't funny because I wish it wasn't true, but here we are. We're laughing.
But here we are. So for me, I don't have that luxury. And so for me, part of my spiritual care and my spiritual nourishment is my body is, has to be part of the equation. And so my friends are part of my spiritual care team and they know, hey, what's going on? And they know, hey, what's on the table? And the first thing they ask is, okay, where is this on the flare up range? Do you need dinner tonight? What's going on? And that is how it has to be for me. So.
Oh, Robert, I knew when I talked to you, you were going to just share a lot of wisdom with us. And, you know, as you're talking, I'm just like, it's so hard earned. And that's what makes their, like, I even experienced grief as you're talking. It's like, yes, you have such a strong sense of your own belovedness because society has not given that to you from day one. Right. And so me and my husband, Kristen, we often talk about like the testimonies that most impact us today, right, are testimonies of people who've had to fight so hard for their belovedness. And I just, but I want to say, like, I know how hard earned that is. And so just the fact that you're able to, you know, even use that to be a safe person, you know, on the internet for people to me is like, I know it's no easy thing, and I wish society treated everybody better. But I do think the pandemic has really brought to mind just the ways we failed disabled people, and you know, that's something I just want to keep learning about. I think as I struggle to retain some spiritual practices, even of like reading the Bible or something like that. I'm just like, well, I'm going to need some friends to read it with me or read it for me and report back, you know, because that's where I'm at. And you're just one of those people for me. And I just really appreciate how intentional you've been about everything. You're doing really good work.
Thank you.
You have quite the community going on Twitter. Do you, just real quick, probably last question, just because I could talk to you all day, but I want to be respectful of your time. Do you view Twitter as a spiritual practice? Do you approach like elements of social media as a spiritual? I don't know what your answer is.
Yeah, I do. I absolutely do. I think that all these emotions just welled up when you asked that question. I think social media can be a light for those who are lonely, those who are trapped in their home, those who are single, those who feel adrift in any way. Maybe those who don't have a church community. Mm. And so for me, I feel intentional about social media and how its place in my life. And it very much is a place, you know, it's not the building, it's the place. But when I go to social media, I only go there to be social. And I think people can get stuck when they don't know why they are there, you know, in any social media, you know, like, why am I here? I'm just scrolling, looking at pictures of people's babies, mamas, friends, cousins, you know. So I don't have any notifications on my phone because I don't play like that. I go there when I'm, let's hang out, let's chat. Mm-hmm. And only then. And then when I'm done, I'm done. And so for me, then it becomes this beautiful thing where I'm like, I want to know and to be known when I'm there. Mm. And it's a big living room full of all the people that I want to be with. And so it's a spiritual practice because there are things bubbling up in my mind that I want to share, and then I place it there. And then to see the most beautiful dialogue happen around that. And then I'm like, I'll leave that cooking on the stove. Because I come there because I'm like, oh, I have this light that I want to bring. Or this funny anecdote. I'll place that warm sizzling. Oh, what? Puppy videos. Twerk videos. That's really cool. And then I block out all the other nonsense. And so
I was going to ask. I was like, is blocking and muting people a part of your spiritual practice, Robert?
It's anointed from on high, child. It's, God bless you forever. The block game is so strong. No one blocks better than me.
I need to learn your ways.
My block game is so redacted strong. I mean, half of Twitter's blocked.
Oh, I need to be more like you. Because I don't, yeah, it's less fun for me.
I block for any reason. I don't like your shirt. You're blocked.
I love it.
It's spiritual. Yeah.
That is amazing. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think that now I got to go block more people. That is my main takeaway
from this gem. That is one gem for you. Block more people.
Yeah. And also, you know, try and read some of the poetry you're reading, because there's just too many amazing people in my life who poetry is a part of their spiritual practice, like daily spiritual practice. I'm like, there is something here. I love it. I love it for everybody. But Robert, I would really encourage anybody listening to find you on Twitter. I don't know exactly what your handle is, but you're Robert the Contemplative. Yep. Do you want to spell out your handle for people?
I think
Robert J. Monson.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
They can find you there. They can find your wisdom, you know, on your two podcasts. Honestly, I didn't know about the second podcast. So I'm really glad you brought that up, because that sounds like my cup of coffee. And I'll be listening to that. But thank you so much for just being willing to come and, you know, share your wisdom, your playfulness, your humor, and just your embodied experience. It was really great chatting with you today.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. Truly.